Would you join me in welcoming our guest speaker this morning, Peter Daniels?
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you here this morning. If you have your Bibles with you, would you open up at the first chapter of Joshua? The first chapter of Joshua, starting at verse 5, and I'll read it to you. It says these words. It says, "No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage. For to this people you shall divide an inheritance, a land which I swore to their forefathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. But then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success." I'm not sure what has been told about my background. I heard a little bit then. But I'm 78 years of age. My wife and I have been married for 57 years to each other. We have 3 children and 8 grandchildren who think I'm the 4th member of the Trinity. I've never gone through formal schooling. I've never had the disadvantage of going to university. I came from a 3rd-generation welfare recipient family with 4 fathers and 2 mothers, and most of my relatives had free board and lodgings with King George VI. That meant they were in jail. I learned to read at 26 years of age after I came to Christ at a Billy Graham crusade. And I started pointing to words in dictionaries. And I went through dictionaries frontwards and then backwards, and then I read 2,000 biographies. I studied law, accountancy, philosophy, theology, modern ancient history, politics, and economics. I found the mind was like a muscle and it could be developed. And I'm here for a number of reasons. Very simple reason. The first one is, what is this dream that you have? It was alive and well when you were younger. You would go for a swim at the beach and lay in the worn sand. You'd stand in front of a wood fire on a cold winter's night or under the starry heavens of a hot summer night, and you would do what men and women in all ages have done. You would contrast that picture of what you are against what you would like to become. Hopefully over the next 72 hours, we'll turn back on that dream machine. Dreaming is not a waste of time. When you dream, you're on the periphery of God's likeness because you're creating something out of nothing. We are heading towards one of the greatest financial shakeups in the history of the world. America owes $90 trillion, if you can put that into perspective, if they only owed $5 trillion, and they could start paying it back a dollar a second, and they started 150 years ago, they have to go 159,000 years to pay their bills. Back 10 years before the fallout, we did 2 films on economics, and we showed America's demise economically 10 years and 1 month before it happened. Predicted the date and we were 1 month out. We submitted the film to the Video and Film Festival in Chicago. We won. We won the gold for directorship and the silver for content. And I'm here to help you economically. I'm tired of Christians being broke. It's time for us to take back the economics. It's time for us to win again. Instead of being employment fodder, suffocating in the amorphous glob of sameness. And we come to church every week in a sense to reassess the Great Commission, not in relationship to its validity, but to our productivity. Productivity is inseparably tied to purity. The scriptural call has never been more valid than it is today, but the productive result from that call had never been so shallow. Never in the history of the world have we had so many people the claim that they are Christians and with so little effect on the community and the countries that we live. As Christians, we look back to the glories of the past. We overlook unbelievable indiscretions and errors. And yet through it all, we see emerging the saints of God standing majestically tall against an old world that had a rural population, poor communication, and often oppressive and severe government and legal systems. But the world is very different now, and we must not measure ourselves against or use the mentors, the saints or condition of the early days, the giant of a bygone era, or the mediocrity of the present to set our course. Jet travel has made the world geographically different. The world has shrunk to the size of a golf ball with international travel. The monetary system is different. The military components are different. The markets are different. People's expectations are different. Even our lifespan is different. But let me tell you that the gospel, the Christian church, has always been the great, silent, unsung hero of every generation, by which its very sovereign charter needs to call afresh with a strong and an urgent voice that our protection does not come from the sword, it doesn't come from the political system, it does not come from a microchip or from our great factories or the state, it comes from the hand of God. And I believe we're moving towards a new era of Christian development, which has its deep roots in our early biblical records, that may call again for believers who will pay any price, who will bear any burden, who will endure any hardship or make any sacrifice and risk or any insecurity to reach the subliminal goal of our gospel call. It may mean a total commitment of personal development and the use of new and strange technologies to fulfill the task. The way that we are behaving with evangelism and with our efforts to change the world are like trying to move Mount Everest with teaspoons. And the world needs to know that we are not pygmies, we are giants. We are not the conquered, we are the conquerors. We are not the downtrodden, we are the uplifted. We do not have a message of death, we have a message of life, and the battle cry is to be the cry to our God to give us unction, action, and victory. And I look at this man called Joshua. The children of Israel went from slaves to conquerors, from wanderings to permanence, to poverty to riches, to aliens to nationhood, from fear to courage, from history observers to history makers. Joshua is a leader. Are you? You better have a look behind and see if anyone's following. I don't believe there's any time in the history of Christendom in 2,000 years that we've had so many seminars on leadership by those who couldn't lead a group in silent prayer. What's happening to us? I look at this man called Joshua. He made progressive use of talents, tactics, and traps. He was the confidence anchor for the timid children of Israel to cling to. He was under God, the directional compass set on a predetermined course for the promised land. He was chosen by God to motivate, to inspire, and to provoke others to desirable action. Joshua exhibited leadership, not brinkmanship. And if we as Christians have not leaders inside and outside the church, and we have not recognized that we are at war and the adversary is the devil, and under such an understanding, then we must accept the responsibility and the pain of leadership. Many years ago, I was asked to do a debate on the free enterprise system, particularly as a wealthy Christian. And when I came out on the stage, the first question they asked, "Mr. Daniels, is it true that you only own one pair of dress shoes?" I said, "Yes, that's right." They said, "Well, why do you only have one pair of shoes?" I said, "Well, that's quite obvious. I've only got one pair of feet." They said, "But you drive a Rolls Royce." I said, "Yes, but I've only got one of them." They said, "Well, could you give us a definition of success?" I said, "Yes, the willingness to bear pain." I didn't say be a pain. But you see, you never win in the comfort zone. You've got to step into the pain arena. Oh, my. I had four people debating with me. I don't think they'd ever studied Shakespeare in Othello, where it says, "Oh God, that man should use his mouth as an enemy to his brain." You see, today leadership and even success in the church appears to be a dirty word. We tend to say all too glibly, "I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me." Then we give light to that assertion. We behave like failures, think like failures, talk like failures, plan like failures, give like failures. Then by some surprise, we wonder why we're failures. You can only be a failure by your own consent. In the book of Hebrews, it says, "Remember your leaders, obey your leaders, greet your leaders." If there was such a thing as a little green man from outer space and he said, take me to your leader, we'd have a hard job finding out who we're going to take him to. We indeed live in a perilous time devoid of any real commitment to leadership. The great William Estancia says the church is in desperate need of leaders. I want to hear a voice, but no voice comes. In a world aflame, the voice of the church has sunk to a pathetic whisper. I think of that great old-time evangelist, Billy Sunday, when he spoke about sin. He said, I'll fight it as long as I got a fist. I'll kick it as long as I got a foot. I'll bite it as long as I got teeth. I'll butt it as long as I got a head. And when I'm old, fickless, footless, and toothless, I'll gum it like a home to glory. And it goes on to perdition. Well, I look at this man called Joshua. Leadership is total life. It's not running a crowd with a head of a crowd with a flag or grandstanding on a platform. Leadership is lifelong. It's not a mantle to be discharged or a burden to be accepted lightly. Leadership is accepting the full responsibility. Leadership is climbing and others are faltering. And God works through optimists. And God is committed to our development. The second thing I see about Joshua, leadership must stay above the commonplace. You see, to be a leader as a Christian is not optional, it's mandatory. We, not them out there, we are told we are the light of the world. We should lead the way. We are salt. We should penetrate everything. Leadership for a Christian is not optional, it's mandatory. I think of my hero, Paul the Apostle. This little guy, my research team held me, and he stood 5 feet tall. Can you imagine this little guy? They say he was shipwrecked, maybe washed up on the beach. Someone would have said, hey, Paul, is that you, Paul? How do you feel about the love of Christ today, Paul? And this little guy would stand up his whole 5 feet and stretch an extra eighth of an inch. He'd put his shoulders back and his chest out and his chin out. And he'd say, unashamed. Unashamed. And when he felt the sting of the lash, someone would say to him, how's your missionary journeys going, Paul? How are they going? And he'd stand there, his whole 5 feet, get a little bit taller, put his shoulders back, his chest out, and bark out the words, unashamed. Then when he was stoned and the flesh was literally falling off his back, someone, I'm sure, would have said to him, Paul, how do you feel about your goals program? Didn't you say I press toward the goal, the mark of my high calling? How do you feel today, Paul? And this little guy would stand up his whole 5 feet and put his shoulders out and his shoulders back and his chest out and bark out the words, unashamed. Then when he was thrown in prison, we hear singing, what a guy. You need a gun, a whip, and a chair to handle a guy like that. Yes, leadership is total life. But leadership must stay above the commonplace. We are an uncommon people in an uncommon cause in a very common world. The Bible says we are a peculiar people. Half of us are nuts. Say, we're a royal priesthood. But we must always be occupied by the final goal. On Tuesday night, I'm going to get two men and two women out of the audience. I'll set their life goals from a biblical perspective. The Bible has a great deal to say about goal setting. Tomorrow night, I'll show you how to go into business and win every time. It's time you own the corporations. And we must develop and exercise perception. We must not be intimidated or put down, irrespective of who or what we're up against. And don't be alarmed at hurtful accusations. When you start to exercise your leadership, someone in the church is going to tell you you're on an ego trip. The ego does not need to be crushed. It needs to be redeemed. The third thing is leadership is different. Christian leadership is different. We have a biblical morality. In 50 years of business, we've never been sued and never sued anyone. We're not going to take the name of Christ into the law courts. We've never had anyone hold their fist up to us and say, we did a bad deal. That's not on our agenda. Leadership is also loneliness. Loneliness. You see, at the pinnacle of leadership, there is loneliness. If you're going to be a leader, you better learn to be lonely. There's plenty of room at the top. Leadership has an inherent loneliness, not as a matter of choice, but as a startling, realistic fact. Loneliness because others refuse to recognize the full commitment and singleness of purpose and pay that price. Loneliness because leadership vision is very personal. Loneliness because of misunderstanding. I'm writing the most comprehensive book or two volumes on leadership that's ever been written in the history of Christendom. And it talks about loneliness. You see, the Bible talks about loneliness as leadership. Jonah alone in the belly of the whale in his plan to reach Nineveh. Jacob alone wrestling with the angel. John the Baptist alone in the wilderness. Moses alone on Mount Sinai. Daniel alone in the den when he stood before Nebuchadnezzar and they said, "My God will rescue us, and even if he doesn't, up your nose with a rubber hose, we're still staying here." Nehemiah alone before the king. David alone before Goliath. Paul alone in prison. "Well, I need someone to help me." Grow up. This is the real deal. Paul alone in prison. Jesus alone. Jesus alone in the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, leadership is total life. Leadership must stay above the commonplace. Leadership for a Christian is different. We have a biblical morality, and leadership is loneliness. Some years ago, I was invited to be Special Ambassador of State on Economic Affairs for a foreign country. When I spoke to His Excellency, the President, I told him that he would have to first accept that I have a higher calling. It's in 2 Corinthians 5:20 where it says, "We are therefore Christ's ambassadors." We are therefore Christ's ambassador. Do you walk like an ambassador? Do you open your home like an embassy? Do people look at you and say, "That person's different"? I wonder what they do. Oh, I had 15 armed bodyguards with submachine guns. I would inspect the troops with the jets flying over. We would have a special position in Parliament with one-inch bulletproof glass. And I was called Mr. Ambassador. But as an ambassador, you're a chosen person. Jesus has chosen you. You have not chosen him. And you have a new title. It's called Christian. The second thing about being an ambassadorship is given by a high authority, and we have the highest authority in the heavens and the earth. The third thing about being an ambassador never ever represents him or herself. We're to represent the one that sent us. Are we a good representation of the Savior? The fourth thing is about an ambassador, they always go to a foreign land. Do you feel uncomfortable here? You don't quite fit in? You feel like a square peg in a round hole? That's all right. Your citizenship is in heaven. And the final thing about being an ambassador is ambassadors are always called home before war is declared. We will meet him in the air. I remember I was walking the streets of Sydney one day with a pastoral friend of mine, and we saw a pair of shoes in the gutter. Immediately, we both looked up to heaven to see if the rapture had come. Yes, you have been predestined to lead. You have been given the principles of God to succeed in that task. You have the knowledge of the outcome. And yes, you have a free will to be a participant or a passenger. The Bible tells us we are more than conquerors. In the old days, when the king wanted to expand his kingdom and bring back treasury for the crown, he would go to the garrison, he would find someone there, brave in battle, loyal to the king, and popular among the men. He would take that person to his senate, and they would interview him and ask him questions of deep magnitude. And if he was suitable, they would give him the armed forces to go and conquer other lands and bring back territory and treasury for the crown. In the early morning light, they would leave the walled city and they'd go off into the horizon carrying the king's insignia. Months would go by. They'd have the watchkeepers on the towers looking to see if the king's insignia was coming over the horizon or the enemy was coming to capture and conquer them. Then one day the call goes out, the king's insignia is coming over the horizon. They'd send out emissaries to find out how went the battle. If they were victorious, they'd make the soldiers wait on the outskirts of the city. They'd send water to wash with fresh food and armor. The king would then go to his musicians and his poets, and he'd ask them to prepare a festival. And then they would wait. And the people would line up along the king's highway and wait for the blast of a trumpet. And when the trumpet sounded, the gates of the city would open and the soldiers would march in perfect unison. The conquered would be slaves in chains carrying booty, and they would lay it at the king's feet and they'd be pushed away. But the soldiers would not look to the left or the right. Their eye would be on the king. They would form rank each side of the throne. And when it was all over, there'd be a hush. The roaring would stop. The clapping would stop. The singing would stop. And then a union of trumpets would sound. And everybody would look to the gate. They'd be lined up in perfect order to the king's highway. And in to the gates would come a chariot with two white stallions pulling the chariot. The hero would be in this chariot. His children would be on the trace horses dressed in white. There'd be a servant behind him holding a garland of flowers above his head in the form of a crown. The stallions would jump and dance up the king's highway. He'd hear people call his voice. The singers would sing to him. The poets would talk of his great deeds. But his eye would be on the king. And as they went, when the pomp and circumstances up the king's highway, the slave behind him would hold this crown above his head and whisper these words in his ears: "All glory is fleeting. All glory is fleeting. All glory is fleeting." Ladies and gentlemen, Christian friends, most of you won't come to the meetings. You'll stay at home and scratch your blessed assurance and say that we'll get by somehow. Well, you're not going to get by. We are professional in this area. People pay me $1 million sometimes for 15 minutes advice. I'm not coming back. I'm going to show you and your family how you can handle it and prosper and take back the economics. Some of you won't come. But those that do come, there'll be people that you won't recognize, that you'll think never amount to anything. They'll do some great things. And some of you will be fabulously rich and powerful. It's happened everywhere around the world. I've spoken in 1,100 churches free of charge right throughout the world. But remember, the glory belongs to God.